Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Acton, Acton, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk USA with me, James Holland, and with John McManus. We haven't got Al today. Don't know where he is quite. He's doing something comedic, I think.
Something comedic in his comedic life and world.
And his, in his yes, the other part of his life, his non-World War II life, his comedy life. But that's okay. You know, we'll miss him, but you and I have got plenty to talk about. And we thought today we'd talk about the Battle of Hollandia. A name that has been erased from the annals, from the maps, because obviously that's a colonial name and goes back to the Dutch East Indies and all the rest of it. Now called Jayapura, but Humboldt Bay still seems to be called Humboldt Bay.
Yeah, Humboldt Bay, I guess, still is, and Jayapura, but in those days they called it Dutch New Guinea in Hollandia.
Dutch New Guinea, and now it's just called New Guinea. It's amazing, isn't it, how there were there's all these battles that took place in the Pacific and elsewhere, of course, in 1943 and into 1944, that just no one knows about. I mean, they're just sort of forgotten history. You know, they've just been sort of so trumped by, I suppose, by the biggies, haven't they? I suppose that's it's ever thus. But the Battle of Hollandia is, you know, April the 22nd to the 6th of June 1944, and obviously we all know about the 6th of June 1944 for other reasons, being the date of D-Day. But big things going on in the Far East.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Normandy, of course, sucks the oxygen out of the room for obvious and good reasons, I suppose. But yeah, all these other really important operations are going on, including this one. This one is a major game changer in what happens in the Pacific-Asia War. And what I mean by that is this is probably the major reason why the Americans are going to come back to the Philippines later in 1944 and, of course, in 1945, which is, in my opinion, you know, as I've said many times, the nexus of the entire war against Japan and from a U.S. view especially. So
this is Operation Reckless, which has one of the best names of any operational names that the Allies use. But there's not very much that's reckless about it at all, is there?
Exactly.
It should be called Operation Safe as Houses, I think.
Right, because it's exactly. They have so much certainty to this on some levels. But yeah, so the background for this, it begins, the story begins like 5 months earlier, at least.
So the end of 1943.
Yeah, when the 20th Division, the Imperial Japanese Army's 20th Division, is sort of retreating west across the New Guinea coast, you know, away from the Australians and the Americans. And as they retreat, they have to just shed all kinds of stuff. I mean, they can't take it with them. It's too hot. They're too overburdened. There's too many problems with disease in the jungle and all that. And so one of the things they're going to discard is their code books. And this unnamed, unknown, anonymous signals officer you know, basically takes code books. And you wonder, why doesn't he burn them? Because there's so much damn rain that they're too soggy to burn. So he stuffs them in a like a steel trunk, and they put it at the bottom of a swamp, and they figure no one will ever find this. But much worse than that is the signals officer tears off the covers and attests to his superiors that the code books were destroyed, which is I one of the things I've said about him over the years is, you know, Benedict Arnold is infamous in the U.S., you know, for being a traitor to the revolution and all this kind of stuff. And he did it really for ego on some levels, but he doesn't do anywhere near as much damage to the to his cause or the American cause in that war as does this guy to the Japanese cause. Because what happens, predictably, the Allies do find the trunk. It's the Australian 9th Division is advancing, and the trunk isn't really that far below the water. And so as the Australians are advancing, I mean, either they see it or they're you know, kind of trawling around for discarded equipment or whatever happens. They find the trunk, they open it, and they're smart enough to realize, hey, you know, this is important stuff. We need to get this back in the higher chain of command. So MacArthur back in Australia has this enormous intel apparatus of, you know, cryptanalysis and whatever else.
But why didn't the Japanese just take it with them? I mean, you know, how big can a Cobra be?
I mean, I guess there's so many and it's so overburdened. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, but I guess my perception is there's so many and so overburdened that they're just having to get rid of everything they possibly can. And you know how, like, when you're massively burdened down, I mean, even 1 pound can be too much.
I guess.
Of course, the code book should have been prioritized over whatever else they're carrying, I guess. But in this case, they don't. And so the Allies basically use...
Well, just chuck it. Kind of dash of petrol over it or something. Maybe the Japanese just don't have petrol.
But they couldn't. I mean, because it was too soggy to burn. Maybe they could have thrown it in the ocean, but they're worried, of course, that it would wash ashore. I mean, I don't know what this guy was thinking.
Yeah,
he does more damage to his cause than Benedict Arnold ever did. I'll tell
you. And what happens to him? Does he get caught out? No, they never know.
I don't. Not to my knowledge. I don't know whatever happened to him. He's anonymous before history, and it's really one of those mysteries. I never chased down the mystery, but he gets away with it, I guess. And
okay, so then the Americans know what's going on.
Yeah, they use early microwave technology to basically dry out the pages, to sort of bake them, and then they piece together the code book. And so they have, for that next couple of months, next several months, the Imperial Japanese Army codes. And so what the consequence of this, it allows MacArthur's headquarters to piece together the entire Japanese order of battle and the disposition of their troops on the northern New Guinea coast. So that's important because now he knows exactly where they are and where they're not. And this allows him to basically pivot on his plans, you know, accordingly. Because so to boil it down, you get two major divisions there for the Japanese, the 20th and the 41st, I think. And their strength is sort of at a place called Hansa Bay and Madang. And MacArthur had planned to invade at Hansa Bay right into the core of their strength. Almost like invading at Calais without knowing you have the strongest German forces there, you know? So,
right.
So now he knows, oh my gosh, that's where they are. Let's not go straight at them. Let's make a larger flanking move farther west at Hollandia, where he knows there's now only about 12,000 rear area service troops, and it'll be an easy nut to crack. And so you can totally outflank these two divisions a little bit further to the east, and then have an easier go. And so the bottom line is being able to do this really accelerates the pace of his operations such that it puts him in the game to get back to the Philippines that year. So it's really quite amazing. And there's a whole deception plan too. And this is the other thing I wanted to mention. It's actually kind of weirdly similar to Normandy on some levels. Now that you kind of have the initiative, you want to mislead the enemy about where and when the invasion is coming, because they know an invasion is coming along the North New Guinea coast, and they expect it to come at Hansa Bay. That's the obvious place. It's the best harbor. It's the most developed. It's, you know, it's where you'd want to be if you had your choice, just like Calais. Hollandia, like Normandy, is a second choice in a way, but an outflanking choice in this case. So what they do is they begin to run bombing missions and destroyer like bombardments and whatnot against Hansa Bay to make the Japanese think the invasion is coming there. They even at night run PT boats up and down the coast and like running their engines really loud.
Where's Hansa Bay?
It's a couple hundred miles east of Hollandia along the northern New Guinea coast. So it's closer to where the Allied bases are.
Yeah.
So it's much closer to where the bases are. It'd be easier to invade there on many levels, of course. But so they're using PT boats to like race their engine to create the impression for the Japanese that there are little landing parties coming ashore to recon the beaches and all this. And then on top of it, you know, you'd wonder, what about the Japanese land-based air at Hollandia? And that is a problem. They've got several hundred fighters based there, and that is beyond the range of the Allied fighters to go and escort our bombers, so the Japanese think. And so General George Kenny, we talked about him a few times, you know, MacArthur's air commander, who's just brilliant. I mean, just a tremendous commander. He, under great secrecy, brings into theater new model of P-38 models that have longer range. And then he fits his existing P-38s with drop tanks And so Japanese propaganda, like Tokyo radio, is taunting the Americans, saying, you know, basically, they're like, you can't get to our planes there. Ha, 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 ha. We're going to clobber your bombers and all this. And so Kenny makes them think that. He prohibits his fighter pilots from flying, you know, a certain range west for a while.
Right.
And then he unleashes this sucker punch of major raids with his bombers, escorted by these, you know, P-38s that now have the range to do so. And they catch the Japanese mostly on the ground and just basically destroy most of their land-based air around Hollandia, thus opening the way for this invasion. So I think it's incredibly like sort of like the transportation plan on some levels of isolating the battlefield, in this case through deception.
Wow. And it's incredibly successful.
It is. So now their Japanese land-based air can't really do anything, and they're not going to expend their naval assets down there. What they really want is a showdown battle, of course, with Nimitz's fleet farther to the north, in the more open waters. And it's, you know, what they're going to try for once you have the Battle of the Philippine Sea in June, which accompanies the American invasion of the Marianas and all that. And so in the meantime, Nimitz and MacArthur have finally started to kind of combine their efforts. The combined chiefs had given them a directive in March, you know, to both sort of do their thing, with Nimitz going to the Marianas, MacArthur doing the Hollandia concept. And so they actually meet in Australia. MacArthur finally is nice to him and invites him to Australia and wines and dines him. And Nimitz comes with gifts for MacArthur, silk pajamas for Arthur, and candy, and, you know, and he hangs out with the MacArthur family for a while. And it's a wonderful stuff.
They bond like crazy.
I mean, they actually do bond in a way, except for there's this weird, awkward moment where they have a banquet or a strategy session, excuse me, where MacArthur's people are sitting down with Nimitz's people and all that. And they're just talking about speculating about what will happen later in 44. And Nimitz says, you know, if we end up going back to the Philippines or not or something. And this just triggers MacArthur. Well, of course, we must go back to the Philippines. We have a mandate. And Nimitz has treated this MacArthuring harangue about the morality of going back to the Philippines and all that. But Nimitz, of course, as you know, is very, very low key, and like, okay, you know, whatever, dude. I mean, that's fine. We'll let our higher ups kind of sort that out later on. But now it really is. This is the first time they really coordinate. And what I think is interesting is Nimitz's forbearance, because they make deals. MacArthur gets Nimitz to agree to have Mitcher's Task Force 58, which is, you know, like the famous fleet carriers, you know, that the U.S. Navy now has, that are going to come and support these landings for a few days in exchange for when MacArthur has his bases in Hollandia, that he'll have his bombers support Nimitz's operations in the Marianas and later on against the Palaus. So they're emerging as partners to some extent. So you have that element to this whole thing too, which I think is.
But what's the overall aim of getting here? I mean, I know this is part of the leapfrogging, but I mean, what are they trying to do?
Yeah, so what they want to do is they want to outflank those entire two Japanese divisions and basically consign them to the New Guinea wilderness. So instead of fighting them head on, why not let them just starve and die out there logistically?
But is the point to use the kind of western half of New Guinea or Dutch New Guinea as a stepping stone to the Philippines?
Precisely.
Do they want to use that? Where, you know, are there some airfields to be dug out of the kind of West Papua?
There's three airfields around Hollandia, like inland, around Lake Sentani. And so they want to develop these airfields into major bomber fields that are going to support the advance farther north to the Philippines. So really, for MacArthur, he wants Hollandia to be his main stepping stone base to go to the Philippines. He wants 200,000 troops to be based there. He wants, wow, a major naval anchorage and those bomber bases and whatever else. So that, yeah, that's why they're going to choose it. And also because it's weak, because they know they're not going to encounter all that much opposition. So,
but isn't it all just a great massive jungle?
It is. I mean, you basically have to create what you're going to have there. And I think that's another thing that's so interesting about it. There's not much there. I mean, this is a Japanese rear area with some warehouses of theirs.
I mean, there isn't much there now, to be fair.
No, of course not. No, there really isn't. And there wasn't then. And I mean, certainly not much local presence too. I mean, many of the locals had you know, sort of gravitated away from the Japanese bases. Some had, some had not.
I mean, I'm looking at it now. There's just a, you know, on the north coast, it's just mighty huge beach with just nothing on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the beaches in that era were very small. So these were not ideal landing beaches for infantry divisions. And this is one of the problems you're going to encounter there. But yeah, I mean, so it's those three airfields, too, are the key objective, as you might imagine. They always are. And yeah, the idea is you're going to seize them, and then the Army aviation engineers come in and will develop those airfields to hold more planes, in particular, our four-engine bombers. Now, ultimately, they're going to be a disappointment along those lines. And so this is another pattern that happens in the war, that MacArthur and Nimitz will cut these deals. And honestly, MacArthur gets a lot more out of them than Nimitz does, because
right,
repeatedly, MacArthur is going to have to, unfortunately, disappoint him and say, well, no, unfortunately, we can't give you the bomber support because the airfields won't support them. And later on Leyte, it's the same story. And so, you know, again, I think Nimitz is incredibly patient with him. If he were a different kind of guy, he would think, oh, that's bad faith, and, you know, come back with venom. But he doesn't, to his credit.
Wow. So how do the plans evolve for it then?
This is the other interesting thing, is that, and it's MacArthur, so there's got to be some dysfunction, doesn't there? I mean, so the Hollandia plan comes out of this intel that's cooking up through the G2 section with Willoughby, you know, Charles Willoughby, who's MacArthur's intel guy. And all of this is sort of germinating at the staff level, sort of in late February, March, like that time frame. And you've got a couple of guys here who have, you know, Kenny being one of them, and then another guy called Bonner Fellers, who we've talked about before.
Oh,
who
ends up
in these interesting places in the war. So, yeah.
Last time heard in operating out of Cairo and revealing British radio traffic.
Yeah. And then, of course, in popular culture, portrayed in the really, I think, kind of awful movie MacArthur, the more modern one, The Emperor's General, whatever that came out about a decade and a half ago, he's portrayed as like the main character, and quite inaccurately as he's portrayed. But in this case, he has this weird title, in which he's, I'll back up. He's working in the G3 section under Steve Chamberlain, who is one of the few normal staff officers MacArthur has. And Bonner Fellers in tandem with George Kenny will both take credit for this sort of Hollandia outflanking concept. So I don't know exactly who we can attribute it to, but I will say this: there's no doubt that Bonner Fellers is on board with it and defies Chamberlain, because Chamberlain is like against it. He's like, no, we can't do this, it's too risky, we'll be too far from our bases, it's not a good place to land, it's just not right for us. And Bonner Fellers defies him and goes straight to MacArthur. He defied a direct order, and he went straight to MacArthur. And so this puts in MacArthur's mind the idea of this outflanking amphibious invasion, in tandem probably with Kenny, with what Kenny is telling him too, I would suspect. But then Chamberlain fires Fellers, but Fellers doesn't go home. MacArthur then says, oh, well, I understand, I'll make you my deputy general secretary or something. And it's like this weird title, and he ends up in PSYOPs, basically. So he's a really interesting figure, but not really in the way portrayed in the movie. But this idea of the outflanking Hollandia invasion is firmly in MacArthur's mind, you know, by March. And he's got in mind that he wants I Corps to carry it out. So that's where Eichelberger comes off the sidelines now, back into the war, in command of this invasion.
No, Eichelberger is in charge of the whole thing, is he?
Eichelberger is in charge of the whole thing, exactly. So it's a Corps level landing. Really, again, quite similar to, say, 5th Corps at Omaha Beach or 7th Corps at Utah. Yeah, there's two divisions, the 24th and the 41st, that are going to have a pincer-style invasion, the 24th in the west, the 41st in the east, and then they're supposed to move inland, seize those airfields, and link up. And it's just all swamp, jungle. It's horrible terrain. And your landing beach is like big enough for three Higgins boats kind of thing in some spots. I mean, it's kind of nutty, and that's what Chamberlain was worried about. He's like, we can't funnelize and bottleneck these divisions on that kind of beachhead, and so that, you know, that's the concern. But I think the 24th and the 41st are interesting too, because the 24th, this is technically their first combat, but really they had seen combat on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th of 41, because many of them had been based at Schofield Barracks and got strafed there you know, when the Japanese planes came over. So some of these guys were really itching to get at the Japanese after training almost 2 years in Hawaii and then 6 months in theater. The 24th is going to be a go-to unit for MacArthur for the rest of the war. And the 41st, of course, had fought alongside Buna. They had fought at San Ananda the year before and they were really a good unit, but they'd had to rehab and refit after that experience. And so the Japanese had given them a new name called the 41st Division Bloody Butchers. And so the 41st Division finds out about this and they start printing up like business cards that show a cowering Japanese soldier and then like a GI with a butcher knife, you know, sharpening them up. And they circulate this among the soldiers. The division commander, Horace Filler, just totally got into it. And so they called themselves the Butchers for the rest of the war.
How funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do now, let's take a break, John. And when we come back, we'll find out how the whole thing plays out. But I'm sensing that Eichel Berker is the big star of this particular operation. Once again, he's the man, right?
As always, yep.
See you in a moment.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome back to We Have Ways to Make You Talk USA with me, James Holland, and with John McManus. And we're talking about the Battle of Hollandia, 22nd of April, 1944 to the 6th of June, 1944. And this is a pretty triumphant battle for MacArthur's US Army forces in the Southwest Pacific.
Yeah. So what's happened is that, you know, in terms of preparing the ground forces, MacArthur had already gone to visit Eichel Berker in January of 44, like late January. So just as a refresher, we talked about this in an episode we did about Buna, but just to refresh everyone's memory.
Because Buna's that island that's off the top of New Guinea, isn't it?
It's not an island. It's on the north coast of Papua New Guinea.
I'm thinking Manus.
Yeah, Manus is a little further, yeah, off the coast and all that. But yeah, in this case, of course, Eichel Berker had won the first American ground victory in World War II at Buna. He performed just magnificently. He's an incredible commander. And of course, at the same time, though, through no fault of his own, he had run afoul of MacArthur on a PR side of things because MacArthur didn't want to share the limelight with anybody. So MacArthur really is quite conniving in this instance that he backbenches Eichel Berker for almost a year in training I Corps. And he prevents the European theater folks from getting Eichel Berker to go there, which they wanted him for at least a corps command, maybe even army command under Eisenhower. So MacArthur kind of...
Oh, that's a salivating thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
Goodbye, Hodges. Hello, Eichel Berker.
I know. Wasn't that intriguing to think of what could have been? How many lives could have been saved, honestly? I know. I mean, it's really kind of dispiriting to think about that because Eisenhower and Eichel Berker had a relationship, knew each other fairly well, and like everything. I mean, you know how they were friends with everybody kind of thing. Eisenhower had told Eichel Berker, I'd really like to have you in my command. And I know he had sounded out Marshall about Eichel Berger's availability. And MacArthur basically tells Eichel Berker to his face, I won't hold you back, But then behind the scenes, he does just that. He holds him back. And so he kind of holds him in his back pocket for when he's going to need him. But, you know, and in MacArthur's defense, of course, is a good commander. You don't want to lose him, and that's understandable. But the conniving is the part that was unnecessary. So bottom line is that MacArthur tells Eichelberger in late January 44, we're going to have some major operation. At that point, he thinks it's going to be Hansa Bay, and we're going to need I-Corps, and we're going to need you to command it. And so Eichelberger, who had been really kind of in the depths of a depression almost over this sort of backbenching, now is really enlivened by it all and very excited to train the troops and go in for this invasion. And in the meantime, then it becomes the whole Hollandia concept. So yeah, he's the ground commander when this happens. The original D-Day is April 15th. They postpone it for a week. You have all those deception operations that I mentioned. And so then these guys are loaded aboard the ships, which is a kind of a torturous experience in the tropical heat. And then you're packed aboard, you know, the LSTs, LCIs. I mean, there's 56 LSTs, I think, at least involved in this operation. So like when we're talking about the pressure on shipping with Anzio and Normandy and all that, and LSTs, how we don't have enough of them. Well, here's several dozen that are in play somewhere else, not to mention what Nimitz has, too, you know. So these guys.
Well, the logistical demands of landing in these places is just immense, isn't it?
It's incredible. Really is. And yeah, I mean, so these guys are going to stage and sally from all these various little entry points and embarkation points and harbors in Papua New Guinea. And then the fleet does all this zigzagging to try and throw the Japanese off as to where, you know, these ships are going before finally kind of uniting to invade at Hollandia. And I should mention, too, there's another little segment to this invasion, which is sort of like the sort of mini Point de Hoc of this, because you take a regimental combat team, detach it, and land it at a place called Etape, which is east of Hollandia by several dozen miles. I don't know. And the whole purpose of that is, you know, if the Japanese control Etape, they're going to be able to have a staging point and fighter bases from which to nail our entire beachhead. We've got to take this, and it'll cover our whole eastern flank and give us fighter support. So the 163rd Infantry does that in this kind of supporting invasion. So meanwhile, the two main divisions invade against very little opposition on April 22nd, and, you know, in that kind of pincers movement.
Yeah, it's quite a big. So what are we talking about distance-wise? It's not that huge, is it?
No, it's about 20 miles between.
There's this bulk, isn't it, between the two?
Exactly. If you can imagine like this almost rectangular kind of hammerhead, you know, along the coast there.
Yeah, it just sort of sticks out, doesn't it, a little bit?
It sticks out. And so you're landing on either side of it in this sort of pincers because and why not on the main beaches that face the sea? Because they're not there. I mean, they just don't exist. And plus, you're going to get bogged down there potentially rather than outflank the Japanese and move directly toward the airfield at Lake Sentani near at the foot of the Cyclops Mountains. So the main problem in the wake of the landing is not really Japanese resistance. It's the conditions.
Yeah. So where are all the, you know, I know the Japanese troops aren't really kind of, you know, they're not there, but they are there, aren't they? They're just not exactly where they're landing.
I mean, some of them will try to resist and they'll just get clobbered. Some of them get nailed by the naval bombardment, but many of them just sort of retreat southward into the jungle. And they just, and the sad thing, they just die there. I mean, in the weeks ahead.
That's it.
They just, some of them are captured. And one of them, when he's captured.
Surprisingly large number, actually.
Yeah. I mean, there's you know, several hundred, which is quite a lot by the standards of this war. There's one of them who when he gets captured, he's just constantly murmuring to his American captors saying, no killie, please, no killie, please. You know, I mean, this guy does not want to fight. He's totally against what you think of when you think of the Japanese soldier fanatical. These are ordinary guys. And so some of them are killed in small engagements there. Some of them take to the swamps and will fight some there. But really, you're dealing with nature as much as anything, yeah, yeah. But also the Japanese aerial response. And so you can imagine how bottlenecked these landing beaches are, how crowded they are, the supplies that are just dumped ashore and you can't get them inland. And so a single Japanese plane comes over on the second night and hits an ammo dump. And it sets off the sympathetic detonations that basically by the time it's done leads to this massive explosion and bonfire, and it kills 24 guys, wounds about 100, It destroys about $6 million worth of property. You know, and this is a single plane. You can imagine if they'd really been able to respond to this. So here is the strength of what Kenny has done to destroy most of their land-based air in the neighborhood. And also what Mitcher's carriers are doing to suppress a lot of them that could be coming from the Palaws or wherever, you know. So, but even as it is, I mean, it's just a near disaster what happens along that beach. And so the soldiers are on half rations for a couple of days, but I think it's amazing how quickly the Americans recover from this. Almost like, again, another parallel, like Exercise Tiger, which is a disaster on so many levels in late April of 44, but it, in the end, doesn't affect whether we can launch the Normandy invasion. Kind of similar here in that respect, that you have this kind of unanticipated setback, but it doesn't really hinder the pace of Eichelberger's operations. So the two divisions link up, you know, I think within 4 days, something like that, the invasion.
Well, that's pretty good going in that terrain, isn't it?
It's really good going. I mean, basically you're moving light infantry columns along narrow trails such as they are. And you can imagine how strung out you're going to be. So if you have in your mind a whole division deployed and advancing on a 3-regiment, put that out of your mind immediately. It's basically whoever is at the spear point with a strung out column of troops and then kind of everything bottlenecked behind them. And that's basically it. So there's fighting. I mean, I don't want to mislead. There is some fighting, definitely, and there are ways to see danger here, but for the most part the Americans are just destroying them and overwhelming. That's the whole concept, to have this happen. So the Japanese are completely caught off guard with this, no idea, and
just not expecting them coming at all.
No, not at all. So those two divisions of the east now are totally outflanked,
because I think in sort of, you know, 3 months of fighting, it's something like 150 killed, 1,000 wounded, something like that.
Yeah, if that. And I think some of that is friendly fire. Some of those is accidents. There's a guy who drowns in a swamp.
Oh, my God.
There's a guy who's like caught in the swamp in quicksand. And one of his buddies tries to get him out by extending his rifle to him, which probably was done under panic. But obviously, it's a live weapon here. And it discharges and it kills the guy in the quicksand. You know, there's these weird incidents that happen like that. They're tragic, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's very different than a lot of these other Pacific theater invasions where you're in the middle of a buzzsaw like Peleliu or Tarawa or whatever, you know, Saipan. So it's not as well known, I guess, because you don't have this sort of legendary resistance by the Japanese, but it's really no less important. It affects the whole war really quite dramatically. And you know how we're always talking about logistics? Then the whole logistical story starts, and I think that's more interesting.
Well, yeah, explain that, because obviously they've now got this northern stretch. They've cleared off the Japanese. Japanese have melted away into the jungle to die. So suddenly the whole of that north coast is now in their hands.
Much of it.
Where are the airfields they want to get their hands on?
So they're right around Lake Sentani. There's three of them, and they're sort of at the foot of the Cyclops Mountains. And Kenny had suspected that they would be good airfields, but he was a little skeptical that they could hold 4-engine bombers. He had a very good feel for this. And that's, if there's any disappointment.
Okay, Cyclops drone, Sentani drone, and Hollandia drone.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. And one of the things the Americans find is that they're probably not going to support 4-engine bombers well enough. And so that's why MacArthur can't make good on his promise to provide that help to Nimitz. But
that's literally the only place where they could put them, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing, isn't it? I mean, on such a huge island, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, there are other parts where you can base the bombers, and the Allies already have them around Port Moresby and all that. But as we go further west, there's not a lot.
I mean, looking on Google Earth now, they're not there anymore. That's for sure. Oh, one of them is. Sentani is. That's amazing.
You have that, but then you've got an anchorage, I mean, a harbor that you're basically creating out of whole cloth. And I think that's kind of what's interesting about this. So Eichelberger goes in there as this operational commander, you know, unleashing this bold coup de main, and does it very well. And by the way, it goes so well that on the day of the invasion, MacArthur's really excited. And he's like, why don't we just go on to Wak Disarmi, which is like several dozen miles to the west, another sort of place you can outflank them. And a lot of the commanders like, yeah, let's do it. And Eichelberger, of all people, who's always the most aggressive, is like, we can't really do that because we don't have enough. Because the main thing is we got to develop the base here. And if we disperse our resources, we're going to lose the purpose of this operation. And it sort of sobers up MacArthur. They're back aboard ship when this happens, and they're all eating like chocolate shakes. And MacArthur gives his to Eichelberger, and he gobbles down like a second chocolate shake. You know, he's so amped up on an adrenaline high over this whole thing, I think. But he's also kind of holding MacArthur in. And I think that was probably the right call. So Eichelberger goes from the sort of bold invasion commander to now having to develop a massive base, a logistical problem. So they construct the army engineers. Construct, you know, dozens of miles of road out of nothing. They build millions of square feet of warehouse.
That's amazing. And is that in the bay or by the airfields?
No, it's closer to the coast. So you almost have two bases, the airfields that are inland.
You have the Humboldt Bay. That's the main one.
That's the main bay. Yeah. And so that's where you're going to build up a lot of your ships and your warehouses, your roads and all that, your pipelines. So there's fuel pipelines, there's wharves, there's cranes and jetties. And I mean, so.
Oh my God. And that's all built specially for that.
It's built over that next 2 months or so. You can imagine the weather doesn't cooperate. I mean, this part of New Guinea gets, what, like 150 inches of rain per year. The temperatures are in the 90s Fahrenheit with high humidity. I mean,
yeah,
it's a horrible place. And
yeah,
so
what
I think this shines a light on is a really overlooked part of the war. And that's the army engineers, who really are the key players throughout the whole war, especially the aviation engineers who are building those airfields and a lot of times those roads. And of course, it's not just a matter of building the road, it's keeping it, because nature intervenes with heavy rains and mudslides and rock slides. And I mean, so Eichelberger is constantly out there every day supervising these engineering operations and keeping roads in service. And he's under the stress because he knows MacArthur wants the base to move to the Philippines, you know, so that he can move on the Philippines. And, you know, that's the pressure from on high. So they're not going to accommodate 200,000 troops, but they're going to get to like 150, something like that. It's really the key base that you're going to have to move on to the Philippines. And it's like,
oh my God. So this becomes a launch pad effectively.
Yeah, it really does. It also becomes the flashpoint for the whole MacArthur legend.
I mean, it's such a huge place of just nothing.
Exactly. And I think that's what's interesting about it, too. This is a microcosm for what the Americans are doing throughout a lot of the Pacific, especially the engineers, is creating something out of nothing. Remember that episode we did about Bougainville and how Bougainville was like this mini American city out there somewhere in the Solomons? This is the same kind of thing. It's this American city that now is in play and has this 1 year heyday or whatever in which we need it for whatever else we're doing.
And then the rest of the time we don't.
Yeah, exactly. And And from Eichelberger's point of view, it shines a light on him and all the things he can do, all these skill sets. You know, he's the guy to launch your invasion and lead it inspirationally and combat and all that. But he's also got this logistical side, too.
Got it. He's a complete general because he can think kind of strategically, operationally, and tactically.
At every level. Yeah. So the MacArthur legend that comes out of this, for years, of course, we didn't know about the whole code breaking thing and that find of the code book and all that. So
that's an amazing story, isn't it?
It really is. And so it seemed like MacArthur, just through his own genius and boldness, had just thought, you know what, I'm going to do this leapfrog and take this great gamble. And it's Operation Reckless, even the term they choose. And for decades, that was the thinking. But now we know. No, actually, he had their playbook, you know, and he had their game plan, and he knew all that. And so I think that I think Ed Dre said something that ought to be called more like Operation Sure Thing or, you know, something like
that.
Yeah,
exactly.
And he's right. But I also do think that this shows MacArthur's mental and strategic agility at this point in the war, of how well he's going to react to intel and work with air and sea forces to make something very productive happen. I think this is one of his finest moments in World War II. Not quite the bold strike we always thought, but, you know, a pretty high-speed kind of operation. also, when they build all this stuff at Hollandia, one of the things they build is a home for MacArthur. And this then gives rise to all sorts of rumors in theater about how he just co-opted all sorts of resources that were needed elsewhere to build this palatial place for himself, that he's like an emperor and he doesn't care about soldiers and all that. Well, actually, there were no resources taken away from everything else we needed. It was a basic, nice new house. And he was hardly ever there. You know, he was there for a few nights of his life. If there was anybody who was there more, it was his chief of staff, Dick Sutherland, who now, this is Jim, this is the other thing that's so wild about this, because this is, after all, MacArthur and his retinue, so it's got to be weird, right? So Sutherland, his just uniformly hated chief of staff, comes to that house and starts to try and co-opt it as his own and try and turn Hollandia in his own little fiefdom to somehow sabotage and undercut General MacArthur. And at one point he tells one of his key aides, a guy named Rogers, he says, Rogers, the general is an old man and he'll soon be, you know, I'm paraphrasing, he'll soon be gone and this will all be under my control now or something. And Rogers are like, what are you talking about? Sutherland brings his girlfriend there and all this kind of stuff. It's just really kind of nutty.
Yeah, and what a place to be. I mean, crikey. I can't get over how remote it is even to this day. So kind of, you know, transposing that into kind of 1944, you know, it gives you such a clear sense of, I mean, you know, for anyone who's listening, it's really worth, if you know, when you get back from the dog walk or when you get a chance to look on Google Earth, and what you need to look up to get it is Jayapura, which is Jayapura. Or you can look up Pegun Ungun Cyclope. So that's Pegunungan. And that will get you there. And you'll see this little, it's not like this bit that sort of juts out from the coastline, and you'll see where it is. And it's there's this sort of lake inland and this little kind of sort of bulge into the lake. And that's where the kind of the airfields are. And it's so remote still. And of course, that means in 1944, it's going to be even more remote.
Yeah.
You know, I never cease to be amazed by the kind of enormous logistical adeptness of the Americans in the war. It's just...
It really is. Here's what Eichelberger writes to Leslie McNair, of course, you know, the head of Army Ground Forces, who unfortunately only has a few more.
He's not going to be alive for much longer.
Yeah. So he's talking about the problem of operating and, you know, the roads and whatnot. And he says, when our tremendously heavy engineer and air equipment first hit that road during heavy rains, it just ceased to exist in places. So he's talking about how our heavy equipment is destroying the roads. And I think this is worth note, because it's like, okay, when you're operating in southern England, you've got roads. You know, Eisenhower has infrastructure to call upon. If you're Eichelberger here, you don't have that. So just something like, okay, here's the heavy equipment we need, but wait a minute, it's going to destroy our roads. What do we do about that? So a lot of times that comes down to a guy with a shovel rehabilitating the road in front of a bulldozer or something. I mean, just like when we step back and think about what this really meant to these guys who were there, I think it's even more impressive because they're in the heat, the rain. I mean, and of course, many of them, as we go forward, are African-American port units that are worked round the clock unloading ships, because that's a big problem. Ships coming in and then...
Yeah. Then you got to unload them and then you got to distribute all this stuff, haven't you?
Yeah. And so that constant pressure of having to unload and build and whatever. So you have the racial dynamic too, just like everywhere else in the Pacific. It really takes us through a lot of layers. You also have command tension between Eichelberger and Walter Kruger, who is still nominally his boss because I-Corps is part of 6th Army. And Kruger's nowhere near Hollandia. You know, he's constantly pressuring Eichelberger. And it's like, I can't believe how many screw-ups there are, you know, how much pilfering there is and how inefficient this all is. And Eichelberger is really building up anger over this and kind of like wanting to say, why don't you come and see it yourself? And then you tell me that this is all screwed up. I mean, so that is a point of tension that's eventually going to really explode later. When Eichelberger's an army commander and you have this big rivalry between Eichelberger and Kruger and their staffs that MacArthur will exploit. And so I think that's what's most interesting in the end is the sort of human story of what's going on here with all this, you know.
Well, it's just fascinating. I mean, I remember reading about it in Iron Infernos, but, you know, I'm not going to lie, it's kind of slightly gone from my mind, you know?
Yours and mine both, I know.
You know, it's amazing how you forget all this stuff, but it's interesting because the Pacific War is this sort of this thing that sort of happens as a sort of adjunct if you're a Westerner and you're a European theater man. And so it's been fascinating over the last few years to kind of sort of build up those sort of blocks of understanding about how it all worked out, how it all plays out. The stepping stones. I mean, they are stepping stones. Each one is its own little self-contained little episode, isn't it? All of its own little forces, its own little kind of start, middle, and end. And then you kind of, but that leads you to the next one and to the next one and to the next one. It's like playing sort of snakes and ladders or something, you know? No, that's not the right analogy, but you know what I mean? I mean, it's like being a board game, isn't it? Where you kind of got to get to there and then you get to the next one and then you get to the next one. Maybe Dora the Explorer is a better analogy.
Yeah, right. It is very sequential, and it takes you all into these little worlds, right? And if you and I happen to be there, that's our world. That's our entire world.
That's your existence. That's your war.
Yeah. What's happening in Anzio or Mietkina or Norman or England or whatever might as well be the moon or something. I mean,
yeah. It's just absolutely incredible.
It's really crazy.
Well, John, that's just been fascinating. Really, really interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, it really is. And it takes, you to the next step of what's going to eventually, lead to the battle of the invasion of Leyte, which from an American standpoint is bigger than our contribution to Normandy. We're going to have more divisions, more troops, more fleet. And so MacArthur's forces are really maturing to become a major command. And, really second only to Eisenhower's command, from the point of view of U.S. resources, I guess. So, yeah, so it fits in that larger piece.
It's a huge commitment, isn't it?
It is. And I think when we get a better sense of this, I think we get a better sense, too, of the dilemma of global strategy, from the sort of bird's eye point of view of the combined chiefs and the kind of decisions they're having to make and how the resources are dispersed and all that. It's really a dilemma on some levels.
Yeah, you bet. Well, I think it's all just fascinating, and we should make sure that we cover all these 1944 battles this year in between the kind of big series that we're doing.
Yep.
Definitely make sure that we continually revisit the Pacific, and we should end the year with a series on, we got the Bulge as well, haven't we? January next year, we should do a series on...
Oh, on Luzon. I mean, that is... Yep. It's huge. I mean, Luzon is one of the biggest battles of the war.
But
especially for the Americans, it's...
Yeah, well, let's do a little series on that. That'd be fun. Anyway, in the meantime, food for thought. John, thanks ever so much. That was tremendous. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we will be back soon. And for anyone who's listening, don't forget we have Waste Fest 19th to the 21st, 18th to the 21st of July this year at Black Pit, which is between Silverstone and Stowe in the UK. Lots of talks, lots of chat, lots of amazing discussion panels, loads of hardware, starring Kevin Heimel, starring John McManus, many of your other favorite World War II historians, and lots of beer and wine and food and stuff to enjoy and things to see as well. So come and join us then. And you can find us on wehavewaysfest.co.uk. But until next time, John, cheerio. And to all of you, cheerio too.
Thanks, Jim. See ya.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator," I said, "you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.